Colonization. Efforts to rebuild ecclesiastical structures in northeastern Germany after 983 were wrecked by the renewed Slav Rising of 1066. Expansion of the empire and imperial church only resumed around 1140, but this time it continued until virtually the entire southern Baltic shore had been Christianized and incorporated within the empire. The extensive forests and underpopulated regions east of the Elbe had attracted Western settlers since at least the 8th century, but the movement only became general and coordinated after 1100. Acutely aware that Germany had lost out in the European scramble to steal other people's lands, 19th century historians adopted the language of high imperialism to present this migration as a legitimate drive to the east, Drang nach Osten, to colonize virgin land and spread a supposedly superior culture. In fact, eastwards migration was part of a much wider movement of peoples throughout the empire, which included forest clearance, marsh drainage, land reclamation and urbanization, all frequently in areas already viewed as settled. People were moving elsewhere in Europe at the same time, such as Spaniards crossing into Arab lands south of the River Ebro, or southern Italians settling in Sicily after its conquest by the Normans. The initial impetus came from the more densely populated areas of Holland, Flanders, and the Lower Rhine, from where people were already moving around 1100 into the western Saxon lands around Bremen. Flemings and Dutch also continued east across the Elbe into the eastern Saxon areas of Altmark and Brandenburg during the 12th century, and were later joined by further waves of Saxon and Westphalian migrants. Hessians and Thuringians from central Germany moved east into the area between the Elbe and the Middle Saale, settling the region that would later become Electoral Saxony. Altogether, 400,000 people crossed the Elbe during the 12th and 13th centuries, causing an eightfold increase in the population of the region immediately beyond, compared to a 39% increase over the next 250 years. Meanwhile, South Germans joined migrants from Luxembourg and the Moselle region in crossing Hungary to settle in Transylvania in the late 12th century. Saxons, Rhinelanders, and Thuringians also headed north to the Baltic coast, while Italians crossed the Alps to live in Germany. New Polish towns attracted Germans, Italians, Jews, Armenians, and Tatars, while Polish settlers headed into Lithuania, Prussia, and later Russia. Each group brought its own legal system, though most lived under what was called German law. This was always an amalgam of different elements, some originating in Flanders. Each successive wave of migrants transformed this law as they moved further east, creating entirely new elements unknown in the West. Certain broad patterns existed through the influence of Lübeck, Magdeburg, and other important cities, providing models for the laws of new eastern settlements. The legal arrangements help explain why people moved. Although the impetus came from areas with high population density, migration was not primarily a product of overpopulation. As Flemish migrants put it, "We want to go east together. There'll be a better life there." The new laws included better property rights, lower inheritance dues, and reduced feudal obligations. Migrants faced considerable hardship, as expressed by the 13th century German proverb, Tod, Not, Brot. The first generation found death, the second experienced want, but the third finally got bread. The greater personal freedoms were guaranteed by Eastern lords, who used them to attract settlers to their sparsely inhabited domains. Slav lords participated in this, like the Polish prince Henrik the Bearded of Silesia, who called on 10,000 Germans to settle 400 new villages he established in 1205. Newcomers, almost always faced mistrust, not least because they enjoyed privileges denied indigenous inhabitants, who remained tied to manorial farms. Assimilation was also slowed by the successive arrival of fresh migrants. Areas experiencing significant initial settlement were transformed, such as Brandenburg, where already by 1220, Slavic-speaking Wends were only a third of the population. Migrants had generally merged with the indigenous population by the 15th century, though some Slavic areas retained their distinct identity, most notably the Sorbs, who remain a distinct group today around Bautzen and Cottbus in eastern Germany. Germans comprised only 40% of Prussia's population, while Slovenes predominated in Krain and Lower Styria. Assimilation could work in the other direction. Germans arriving in rural parts of Prussia and Poland became Polonized, and though they predominated in the towns, this was not invariably the case, and by the 16th century, German was no longer understood in Krakow. Descendants of medieval settlers often reacted with hostility when a new wave of German eastwards migration began in the 18th century. The initial phase of colonization was accompanied by considerable violence, reinforcing a sense of a frontier and contributing to the lasting contradistinction between German and Slavic identities. The arrival of additional labor reduced the dependency of frontier communities on slave raiding, whereas those Slav communities still further east continued attacks for captives. Coupled with factors like material and technological differences, this fostered the self-perception among German communities of their inherent cultural superiority. The Northern Crusades. Animosities were inflamed by the new language of holy war accompanying the empire's eastwards expansion. Popes already blessed warriors and their weapons in the 10th century, and from 1053 offered remission from sin to men fighting their enemies. Initially, these indulgences were granted to those fighting the Normans, but from 1064 they were extended to campaigns against Muslims. Gregory VII prepared the ground for what became the Crusades by stigmatizing his enemies as heretics. The ideologically charged investiture dispute nurtured new ideas about violence, involving sharper distinctions between Christendom, as a realm of peace where killing was condemned as murder, and an external world where exterminating infidels glorified God and Christians dying in combat became martyrs directly entering heaven. The most concrete expression of these beliefs were the new military orders, whose members combined monastic vows with the duty to protect pilgrims traveling to the Holy Land. The Templars are perhaps the best remembered today, but never had a significant presence in the empire, in contrast to the Hospitallers, who were founded in 1099 and known in the empire as the Johanniter, or Knights of St. John. They established their first German house at Duisburg in 1150. And were followed by the Teutonic Order formed in the Holy Land in 1190, which had seven houses in the Lower Rhine by 1261. The crushing defeat by the Turks at Manzikert in 1071 forced the Byzantine Emperor to call on the despised Latins for assistance. The first full crusade was eventually proclaimed by Pope Urban II at the Council of Clermont in November 1095. The initial part of the ambitious program was achieved with surprising ease when Jerusalem was recovered after 463 years of Muslim rule in 1099, leading to the establishment of a new Crusader state in the Holy Land. The second goal of reunifying the Eastern and Western churches quickly founded on the Pope's insistence on supremacy over Constantinople's Patriarch. By 1105, the papacy was actively encouraging the Normans to conquer Byzantium, a redirection of resources that ultimately contributed to the failure of the entire crusading enterprise over the following three centuries. Crusader ideology was employed against Western Christian opponents already in 1102, when Pope Paschalis II backed one of Henry IV's opponents in a struggle over the bishopric of Cambrai. This was one of the many local conflicts characterizing the confused final phase of the investiture dispute. The ideology was employed more extensively by Gregory IX and Innocent IV, who redirected armies bound for the Holy Land to fight Frederick II in the final stage of the papacy's conflict with the Staufers. Outside Italy, Crusader ideology assisted the empire's expansion. What became known as the Northern Crusades opened as a second front declared by the Pope in 1147 to attack the Wends and other Slavs north of the Elbe. The initiative lay with Count Adolf II of Holstein, who began by evicting Slavs from Vagria and replacing them with Flemish and German settlers, many of whom helped found the new town of Lübeck in 1143. Official sanction as a crusade attracted Germans, Danes, Poles, and some Bohemians to Adolf's army, allowing him to greatly expand operations. Indulgences on this front could be won at a lower cost and in a fraction of the time necessary to complete a pilgrimage to Jerusalem. The cooperation of the Polish and Pomeranian dukes proved crucial to success. These Slavic princes were engaged in Christianizing their own lands as a means to enhance their authority and possessions. Their involvement expanded the scope of the Northern Crusades from the area immediately north of the Elbe, eastwards along the Baltic shore through Prussia, and into modern Estonia, Latvia, and Lithuania. Much of this region had been conquered by 1224, assisted by the Pope's sanction of the Knights of the Sword, a new military order who soon became rulers of the area north of Riga, known as Livonia. The heathen Prussians were driven from the Vistula estuary in the later 11th century, only to spread across the Polish Duchy of Masovia, prompting Duke Conrad to appeal for aid in 1226. The call was answered by the Teutonic Order, which had transferred to fight in Hungary, only to be expelled in 1225 for being out of control. Operations were temporarily dislocated by the devastating Mongol invasion of Poland in 1240-1241, which eliminated much of the Polish elite. Although the Mongols soon retreated, Pope Innocent IV had been persuaded to proclaim a permanent Baltic Crusade in 1245, legitimizing regular recruitment for the Teutonic Order. Four hard-fought campaigns secured Prussia by 1280. The emperor was hardly involved in either colonization or the Northern Crusades, which, together, achieved the largest expansion of the empire since Charlemagne. Although Frederick II issued his own authorization to the Teutonic Knights, the order acted independently in carving out its own state, which eventually succumbed to a resurgent Poland around 1500. Secularization of the order's territory in Prussia by the then relatively insignificant Hohenzollern dynasty in 1525 did not affect its other possessions, which were grouped into 12 bailiwicks across the Rhineland, South and Central Germany, and Austria. The order retained its crusader privileges, making membership highly attractive for German nobles. Any land donated to it was immediately freed from previous debts. The senior Grand Master remained based in Germany and had been raised to the status of Imperial Prince in 1494, followed by his counterpart in the Knights of St. John in 1548. These elevations integrated both orders and their leaders into the Imperial Church, with their lands becoming immediate Imperial fiefs, though the Knights of St. John remained part of an international organization based in Malta. The Teutonic Grand Master remained Catholic, but the order accepted Protestant nobles after the Reformation. The Hussites. A century after the Northern Crusades, the empire engaged in a final internal crusade against Bohemian Hussitism, the most important heretical movement prior to the Reformation as well as the largest popular rising prior to the Peasants' War of 1524 to 1526. The late medieval concern for individual belief intersected with the growth of written culture to make heresy easier to identify as deviance from approved texts and practices. The Hussites took inspiration from Jan Hus, the rector of Prague University, who was treacherously burned at the stake in 1415 after the Luxembourg monarch, Sigismund, reneged on a promised safe conduct to present Hus's case at the Council of Constance, 1414 to 1418. Although the Hussites established their own national church in 1417, their movement soon split into millennialist Taborites, operating from the town of Tabor, and moderate Utraquists, named after their practice of communion in both kinds, sub utraque specie, bread and wine. Opposition to Sigismund's accession as Bohemian king in 1419 briefly reunited the factions and led to their conquest of most of the kingdom. Sigismund received papal indulgences for five major expeditions between 1420 and 1431. Most crusaders came from Germany, Holland, and Hungary, where Sigismund was also king, despite the appeal being directed throughout Christendom. A 3,000-strong English detachment arrived on the continent in 1427, but were redirected to fight Jeanne d'Arc in the Hundred Years' War, a further indication of the manipulation of indulgences to advance secular goals. The imperial counterattacks were repulsed by the Hussites' determination and superior tactics, but also because the emperor was simultaneously engaged in defending Hungary against renewed Turkish invasion. Eventually, the situation was defused through the compactor of 1436 between the Bohemian Catholic elite and the Utraquists, who formed the majority of the population. Utraquist practices were tolerated in return for their formal submission to Rome. The defeat was greater for the papacy than for the empire. For the first time, the Pope had allowed heretics to present their case and made significant concessions. Sigismund's rule was secure in Bohemia, while the episode provided a significant boost to constitutional reform, eventually giving the empire its definitive shape around 1500. Bohemia remained within the empire despite its distinctive religious arrangements, and even the accession of an openly Utraquist king, George Podiebrad, in 1458. The Emperor as Jewish Advocate. The Jews and the Empire. The story of the Jews and the Empire is much like imperial history generally, far from perfect, occasionally tragic, but generally more benign than that of other places or times. Although marginalized in most accounts, their history reveals much about the empire's social and political order. Charlemagne revived late Roman imperial patronage of the Jews, who had retained legal recognition in most of the Germanic successor kingdoms since the fall of Western Rome in the late 5th century. Jews made significant contributions to Carolingian artistic and commercial development, particularly through their roles as intermediaries in selling captive Slavs as slave soldiers to Iberian Muslim armies. There were around 20,000 Ashkenazi Jews in the empire north of the Alps in 1000, mainly in Mainz, Worms, and other Rhenish episcopal towns. The Carolingian and Ottonian elite remained ambivalent, conscious that Jews and Christians shared the Old Testament, yet only Jews could read the original Hebrew text. Imperial protection was inconsistent. Otto II often assigned powers over Jews to bishops as part of broader privileges intended to boost the development of cathedral towns. Adverse circumstances could prompt punitive measures against Jews, notably under Henry II, who was decidedly less tolerant. 2,000 Jews were expelled from Mainz in 1012, though the decree was revoked the following year. The most significant step came in 1090, when Henry IV issued a general privilege to Jews, modeled on those granted to individuals by Louis II over 2 centuries earlier. Probably prompted by the significant growth in the Jewish population in Worms and Speyer, Henry assumed the position of Advocatus Imperatoris Judaica, or General Protector of all Jews in the Empire. This established arrangements that persisted until the Empire's demise in 1806. The safeguarding of Jewish economic, legal, and religious rights was reserved as an imperial prerogative, linking imperial prestige to effective protection. Like other arrangements in the Empire, implementation varied according to circumstances, while protection rights were often devolved along with other privileges to more local figures. Enforcement became less consistent, but over time, Jewish privileges were woven into the general web of imperial law, affording Jews by early modernity a surprising degree of autonomous protection. Pre-modern toleration should not be confused with modern multiculturalism, equality, and the celebration of diversity as intrinsically good. Jews remained protected, provided they accepted their second-class status. Diversity was feared, but also recognized as beneficial. Jews had a specific socio-economic role, assuming tasks that Christians were unwilling or unable to perform. Jews also played a cultural part as the other, reinforcing Christian group identity, often at considerable cost to themselves. Pogroms and extortion. Imperial protection of the Jews foundered almost immediately when Henry IV was trapped by his enemies in northern Italy and unable to prevent the first serious pogrom in German history in 1096. Proclamation of the First Crusade in November 1095 coincided with widespread suffering from flooding and famine. French preachers spread the standard accusations of Jews as usurers and Christ killers, calling on the Crusaders to eradicate them as they marched to the Holy Land. Already licensed to kill by papal indulgences, the crusading army wreaked havoc as it moved east from Rouen into the Empire, where it was joined by impoverished German knights who saw a chance for plunder. Jews were told to convert or die, with many choosing suicide as the Crusaders marched up the Rhine. Only the pro-imperial bishop Johannes of Speyer used force to uphold imperial protection. Once he managed to escape to Germany in 1097, Henry blamed Archbishop Ruthard of Mainz for the pogrom. Jews who had been forcibly converted were allowed to return to Judaism, despite Ruthard's protests. Imperial protection was renewed and incorporated in the general public peace declared for the empire in 1103. Frederick Barbarossa acted swiftly to prevent a repeat of the pogrom when 10,000 gathered in Mainz to take the cross for the Third Crusade in March 1188. He publicly praised loyal Jews, and when a mob threatened violence against them, the imperial marshal, taking his servants with him and his staff in his hand, smote and wounded them until they all dispersed. Frederick II made an important adjustment when he renewed Henry IV's legislation in 1234. As with many of Frederick's actions, this was not as progressive as it first appears. The emperor vigorously rejected the myth of Jews committing ritual child murder, which so often provided an excuse for pogroms. Christians killed 30 Jews in Fulda after 5 Christian children died in a house fire at Christmas 1235. The case was considered sufficiently serious to be transferred to Frederick's own royal tribunal, which publicly rejected the excuse of ritual murder and renewed imperial protection for all Jews early the next year. Frederick's legislation inspired similar measures in Hungary, 1251, Bohemia, 1254, and Poland, 1264. Unfortunately, It also incorporated Pope Innocent III's transfer of religious animosity to secular law, promulgated a few decades earlier. Arguing that Jews inherited the guilt of Christ's death, Innocent had imposed permanent servitude as a punishment. This aspect was expressed in Frederick's verdict in 1236, which subordinated the empire's Jews as servants of the chamber, Kammerknechte. Protection was now dependent on payment of an annual tax, known since 1324 as the sacrificial penny, levied on all Jews older than 12. An additional crown tax was payable on the accession of each new king. Imperial protection for Jews remained patchy. Three-quarters of Frankfurt's 200-strong Jewish community died in a pogrom in 1241, while Jews joined other migrants heading east in search of a better life. Nonetheless, the situation was probably similar to that in Spain and compared favorably to England or France. More significantly, this persisted despite weaker royal power after 1250, providing a further indication that decentralization should not be misconstrued as decline in the empire's history. Later 13th-century kings sold or devolved to lords those rights to protect Jews as part of a wider strategy to buy support. Consequently, both the number of Jewish communities and their lordly protectors multiplied, so that there were 350 communities across Germany by the mid-14th century. This did not immediately strengthen protection for the Jews, since overall responsibility remained with the monarch, who could switch track, as Charles IV demonstrated with fatal results. Charles assumed power in the middle of a civil war in 1346. The papal interdict against his predecessor, Louis IV, had left large parts of the empire without Christian services by 1338, stoking anxiety that deepened dramatically with the Black Death a decade later. Charles crudely exploited his prerogatives to win support by encouraging pogroms, even offering immunity in return for a share in the spoils. 600 Jews died in Nuremberg, where the Marienkirche was built on the ruins of their synagogue, while only around 50 communities across the empire survived, largely by paying huge ransoms. The privilege of protecting Jews, Judenregal, was included in the wider bundle of rights granted to the electors in the Golden Bull, cementing the new alliance between Charles and the empire's political elite in 1356. His son and successor, Wenzel, repeated this shameful extortion, receiving 40,000 florins from the Swabian cities in return for allowing them to plunder their Jewish populations in June 1385. And he did this again, 5 years later, in alliance with several princes. Meanwhile, Jews faced growing discrimination, including exclusion from long-distance trade. Again, much of this was fueled by the empire's elite, who were imposing heavier taxes on Jews, who were then obliged to pass increased costs onto their Christian customers by charging higher interest on loans. Early modern protection. Nonetheless, in the longer term, the devolution of protection for Jews blunted this abuse of power by widening the circle of those with a vested interest in better relations. Throughout the bad times of the 14th century, individual lords and imperial cities preferred peaceful coexistence. Regensburg and Ulm refused to cooperate with Charles's measures, and while Frankfurt expelled its Jews in 1349, it allowed them to return in 1360. The community thrived, doubling across the late 15th century to total 250 by 1522, and then rising rapidly, reaching 3,000, or 11% of all inhabitants by 1610. The Habsburg Albert II was the last monarch to attempt extortion, and, significantly, this failed to raise much money, despite the richer and larger Jewish population. His successor, Frederick III, reactivated imperial protection by claiming all Jews were his immediate subjects. Frederick too hoped to raise money, but this time through the regular sacrificial penny, and he vigorously resisted calls from Christians to reinstitute extortion. He was criticized as too soft and mocked as King of the Jews. More positive attitudes were emerging around the time of Frederick's death in 1493. Humanists and early Protestant reformers were interested in Hebrew as a means to understand Christianity's origins. Sebastian Münster's book, Hebraica, sold 100,000 copies, making it one of the world's first bestsellers. The personally anti-Semitic Maximilian I, Frederick's successor, was dissuaded from renewing persecution by the humanist Johannes Reuchlin, who argued in 1511 that Jews had been Roman citizens since late antiquity. Rapid socio-economic change, passion stirred by the Reformation, and the reformers' disappointment at failing to convert Jews to Protestantism all contributed to a more threatening atmosphere around 1530. Jews were expelled from at least 13 Protestant and Catholic territories and cities between 1519 and 1614, reducing their main communities to Frankfurt, Friedberg, Worms, Speyer, Vienna, Prague, and Fulda Abbey. Anti-Semitism remained a depressing feature of rural as well as urban protest throughout early modernity. However, the continued grant of Jewish protection rights to princes created new communities in Fürth, Minden, Hildesheim, Essen, Altona, Crailsheim, and the Duchy of Westphalia from the 1570s. Others, like Ansbach, readmitted communities they had previously expelled. The new pattern of protection again changed the character of Jewish settlement, which now spread into the countryside from imperial cities and princely residence towns. Meanwhile, refugees from the Dutch Revolt founded the empire's first Sephardic community in Hamburg during the 1580s. Jews and imperial law. Emperor Rudolf II, reigned 1576 to 1612, was genuinely interested in Jewish culture and banned Luther's anti-Semitic books. However, the empire's development as a mixed monarchy proved a far more significant factor in the improving conditions. Unlike in centralized monarchies, toleration no longer depended on the whim of individual monarchs. Devolution of protection for Jews embedded responsibility within the general web of privileges and rights enshrined in imperial law. Imperial protection was renewed 5 times between 1530 and 1551, and became part of the general legislation passed by all imperial estates through the Reichstag, linking the integrity and prestige of all political authorities to ensuring observance. The 1530 law did oblige all Jews to wear a yellow star. This was widely ignored, and then formally overturned by the Reichstag in 1544. All forms of harassment were now prohibited. Jews were guaranteed free mobility, protection for their property in synagogues and against forced conversion, and were permitted to charge higher interest rates than Christians. Jewish self-government also secured legal recognition. Local authorities had to obtain permission from higher sources before expelling a Jewish community. Individual Jews remained subject to numerous restrictions, such as denial of full citizenship in cities, but could own property, including weapons, and could participate in wider aspects of the empire, including using the Imperial Postal Service. Imperial criminal justice remained neutral towards religion. Prejudice certainly affected judgments, but the new imperial supreme courts created in the 1490s were concerned with adhering to formal procedures. For instance, Jewish prisoners could observe religious rituals, even where they had not requested this. Like peasants and other socially disadvantaged groups, Jews were able to make effective use of imperial laws to defend their rights after 1530. For example, Emperor Ferdinand I's own supreme tribunal, the Reichshofrat, disregarded his anti-Semitism and upheld an appeal from the Jewish community in Worms against the city council's decision to expel them. Such cases have wider significance because the empire's judicial system is widely perceived as deficient, thanks to a systematic late 16th century campaign by Protestant zealots to discredit their Catholic opponents, much of which was accepted as fact by later historians. Precisely when some Protestant princes were complaining loudly of religious bias, Jewish communities were quietly and effectively obtaining legal protection against princely and civic persecution. This is best demonstrated by the notorious Fettmilch incident, the worst anti-Semitic outburst between the mid-14th century and the 1930s. Frankfurt's Jewish community became the scapegoats for wider problems in the city around 1600, including rising taxation, falling wages, and an increasingly oligarchical government perceived as out of touch with ordinary inhabitants. The artisan leader Vincenz Fettmilch accused Jews and patricians of exploiting the poor, inciting a mob that attacked both the city hall and the ghetto where the city's Jews had lived since 1462, murdering 262 and plundering property worth 176,000 florins in 1612. Violence spread to Worms, where Jews were expelled. Although the outbreak had not been prevented, punishment was swift and effective. Fettmilch and six associates were executed, while legal injunctions prevented other cities from expelling their communities. Worms was forced to readmit its Jews in 1617. Overall, Jews brought 1,021 cases to the empire's Supreme Court, the Reichskammergericht, representing 1.3% of its entire caseload between 1495 and 1806, though they only numbered 0.5% of the empire's population. Meanwhile, they were also involved in 1,200 cases before the Reichshofrat between 1559 and 1670, or 3% of that court's business. The persistence of established structures. Protection for the Jews continued despite the upheavals of the Thirty Years' War, 1618 to 1648, while the surge in violent anti-Semitism accompanying the hyperinflation of 1621 to 1623 did not see a repeat of the earlier pogroms. The immediate post-war decades after 1648 saw a renewed wave of expulsions, with Jews driven from 10 territories and cities, including Vienna. But these were more limited than those of the 16th century, while many authorities now actively encouraged Jewish immigration to help repopulate their lands. Already in 1675, 250 families were allowed to return to Vienna, while that year, Duisburg University admitted its first Jewish students, far ahead of institutions elsewhere in Europe. Territorial governments observed their legal obligations, even though they no longer derived significant financial benefit. Only Frankfurt's Jews still paid the sacrificial penny in the 18th century, which brought the emperor a mere 3,000 florins annually, while Jewish taxes in Munster accounted for just 0.1% of the bishopric's revenue. The Jewish population grew faster than that of the empire overall, rising from under 40,000 in 1600 to 60,000 by the later 17th century, with an additional 50,000 in Bohemia and Moravia. Although main centers were still urban, notably Frankfurt and Prague, 9 out of 10 Jews now lived in the countryside, either in the 30 principalities with communities, or amongst the 20,000 living on the lands of the imperial knights by the late 18th century. The knights saw Jewish protection as a way of asserting their otherwise vulnerable autonomy. The Jewish population continued to grow faster than that of Christians, totaling 250,000 by 1800, with a further 150,000 in the lands recently annexed by Austria and Prussia from Poland. Economic arguments and liberal ideas associated with the Enlightenment are usually used to explain the improving conditions leading to 19th century emancipation. This links the standard narrative of progress to the centralized state, exemplified in Central Europe by Prussia and Austria. Both these lands were largely outside the web of imperial laws by the late 18th century, so we would expect the position of Jews there to be better than in the more politically fragmented areas of the empire. This was not the case. The situation in the Habsburg monarchy was not always favorable prior to the 1781 toleration edict, and in 1745, the Ottoman Sultan lodged a formal protest at Empress Maria Theresa's treatment of the Bohemian Jews. Frederick William I forced Prussia's Jews to pay a new tax in 1714, in return for dropping requirements to make them wear a distinctive red hat. The Berlin court printer circumvented the imperial censor to publish Johannes Andreas Eisenmenger's Jewishness Revealed, the first modern anti-Semitic book that was banned in the empire, but it now appeared from a press supposedly based in the Prussian town of Königsberg, beyond the imperial frontier. The brilliant Jewish intellectual Moses Mendelssohn, visiting Berlin in 1776, was made to pay a head tax fixed at the rate levied on cattle passing the main city gate in a deliberate effort to ridicule him. His treatment reveals the hollowness of Frederick II of Prussia's much-celebrated toleration. Legal protection for Jews could still fail elsewhere in the empire, as exemplified by the notorious show trial and execution of the financier Joseph Suss Oppenheimer, who was made the scapegoat for discredited government policies in Württemberg in 1738. However, the authorities had a vested interest in upholding protection, since their own privileges and status were at risk if they failed to do so. The contrast with other parts of Europe is perhaps best illustrated by one final case. Prince de Rohan fled revolution in his homeland of France by moving to his German properties at Ettenheim in 1790, where he evicted several Jewish families to make room for his courtiers. The families promptly obtained redress from the Reichskammergericht. Reformations. The Reformation in the context of imperial history. The Jews formed the empire's only religious minority between the decline of paganism amongst the Slavic populations around 1200 and the emergence of Hussitism over two centuries later. The most significant challenge to conformity came with the Reformation after 1517. The Reformation's uneven outcome reinforced the political and cultural distinctions between the empire's primary territorial components, including the drift of Switzerland and the Netherlands towards independence. The causes of this cultural earthquake lie beyond this book's scope, but we need to note the context in which it emerged, since this explains why the new religious controversy differed from those of the medieval empire. Papal concordats with individual monarchs since the early 12th century fostered the growth of more distinct national churches across much of Europe. This process accelerated rapidly around 1450 and contributed to Charles V's inability during the 1520s to repeat Sigismund's success at the Council of Constance by addressing the Reformation through a single church council under his leadership. Meanwhile, the empire was also changing rapidly through the institutional changes collectively labeled Imperial Reform around 1500. Crucially, these changes were incomplete by 1517, ensuring that resolution of the crisis became enmeshed with constitutional developments. The context also contributed to Luther's failure to restore what he regarded as the original, pure Christianity by elevating scripture to the sole basis of truth. The relative decline in papal and imperial authority meant there was now no single authority to judge his beliefs, which were, as a result, accepted, rejected, or adapted by a host of national and local communities. Religious issues affected broad aspects of daily life, as well as personal salvation, adding to the urgency of their resolution. Attempts to diffuse controversy by clarifying doctrine proved counterproductive, since fixing arguments in writing simply made the disagreements more obvious. Moreover, the new print media ensured rapid dissemination of the diverging views, igniting arguments across Europe. Once the initial splits had occurred, it became harder for those involved to repair them.